Coming up on Tech Nation, how exactly did Edward Snowden deliver those classified government documents into the hands of the media? Former Washington Post investigative journalist Bart Gellman, the author of Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State, relates his off-the-grid experience. Then TechNation Health chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the potential for genetic susceptibility to the COVID-19 virus and other aspects of genetic predisposition, which even extend to the success or failure of medical treatments. All this and more coming up on this week's TechNation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 2011, National Geographic explorer in residence Wade Davis wrote Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and The Conquest of Everest. Today, a full century later, we have satellite imaging and GPS, satellite phones, and the experience of 100 years of climbing. But in the 1920s, what did climbers know about climbing Mount Everest?
Well, they knew very, very little more. I mean, you know, Everest had sort of emerged in the last years of the Raj as sort of the third pole. You know, the British and Empire of Explorers had lost the race for the North and South Pole, and here in their very midst was this third pole that rose into the heavens. And so the quest for Everest began really as a sort of a gesture of redemption for an Empire of Explorers that had lost those races. But because of the intervening war, where so much of Britain was destroyed by the Mud of Flanders, it emerged as a kind of a gesture of regeneration for a nation bled white by war. So that was always my interest in the story of George Mallory.
In a sense, the empire, the great global empire of Britain, has really been gnawed by the Great War.
Well, you know, that was a seminal event of our times. You know, Churchill famously described the Second World War as just second half of the First World War. He called it the 30 Years' War. And he famously said, never was there a war less necessary to fight than the first, or more necessary to win than the second. I became interested in the story of George Mallory really in a serendipitous way. I was traveling 4,000 miles across Tibet as part of an ecological survey in the spring of 96 when the disaster happened on Everest that John Krakauer so powerfully wrote about in his book Into Thin Air. And with me was Daniel Taylor, who was a son and grandson of medical missionaries, and his father had been a great friend of Howard Somerville, who climbed with George Mallory in 1922 and 24. And the very next fall, Daniel and I were back on the east face of Everest, in the Kanchung face, in the Gamma Valley, trying to photograph clouded leopards. And Daniel, in his inimitable way, began to speak of these Englishmen in tweeds reading Shakespeare to each other in the snow at 20,000 feet. And that was the Everest of his imaginings, not the kind of ignoble commercial world of today. And as he spoke to me, I became enchanted by these men. Who were they? And I was never interested in whether George Mallory made it to the top or not on that fateful day. You know, the story goes, on June 8th, 1924, he's spotted by Noel Dell with his young companion, Sandy Irvin, going strong for the top on the Northeast Ridge, with a mist coming in that envelops their memory and myth, and they have never seen or heard from again. The question is, did Mallory make it before he died? And what interested me is what spirit carried him on. In 1921, the reconnaissance of Everest was just that. They had to find the mountain. They had to march 400 miles off the map
To find it,
to get to the base of a place that had been seen from Kampazong, but never approached by any European. And on that approach march, a high-altitude physiologist by the name of Arthur Kellis, 56 years old, too old for Everest, famously died of exhaustion. And he was buried at a Tibetan fort called Kampazong. Now, according to historians of Everest, in 1921, only one man kept a journal. But I found alive, 4 doors from the house I was born in Vancouver, the son of a man who did, Oliver Wheeler, unknown, unsung hero of 1921, the man from the Survey of India, seconded to the expedition, the man, not Mallory, it was Wheeler who found the doorway to the mountain, the route up the East Roanoke to the North Col. He was the one who famously found the chink in the armor of Everest. And Wheeler kept a journal. And when I visited his son, he pulled these 2 volumes off his shelf, and I was breathless. never before seen by every historian.
You've been listening to a 2011 TechNation interview with National Geographic Explorer-in-Residence Wade Davis about his book, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Today, a University of British Columbia anthropology professor, Wade Davis has recently published Magdalena, River of Dreams, A Story of Columbia. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, investigative journalist Bart Gellman takes us inside his interactions with Edward Snowden, which resulted in receiving classified government documents. We'll talk about his book, Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State. Then TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft discusses our potential for genetic susceptibility to the COVID-19 virus, a new field of inquiry.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Bart Gellman. Well, Bart, welcome to Tech Nation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you know, it's one thing to be an investigative journalist. I mean, you weren't looking into who pilfered the bake sale money. You were investigating the activities of security agencies in the U.S. and internationally, not to mention the person who crossed them, put you firmly in the eye of numerous governmental agencies and operatives. How was that working for you?
Yeah, well, it was a new experience, and it was numerous governmental agencies from numerous countries. By receiving the Snowden documents, a large cache of highly classified documents that describe the activities of the NSA, I was painting a big target on my back. I became interesting to the governments of China and Russia and Iran, and it turned out also, as I discovered, the government of Turkey tried to hack my Google accounts. I was anticipating trouble. I was anticipating efforts to steal the material from me and steal my notes. And I was anticipating efforts on the U.S. government side to stop me. All of those things bore out as time went on.
Now, let's remind everybody, what did Snowden do? When did he do it? And why was it so bad?
So we're going back now to 2013. Snowden is a contractor working for the National Security Agency in Hawaii. He's an infrastructure analyst, which is what they call someone who is trying to detect and thwart incoming hacking efforts by a foreign adversary like China. He has previously been a systems administrator in charge of running the network and the system of classified computers at the NSA's Hawaii outpost. And he makes off, he steals tens of thousands of documents. He copies them, he brings them with him, and he flies off in secret to Hong Kong, where he makes contact with journalists, including me.
Now, let's go to Snowden here. Many people have watched Citizen 4, and you still can. It's out on the internet, a 2014 documentary, which won an Oscar for Best Documentary Feature, directed by independent filmmaker Laura Poitras. And it recorded the moments at the release of the published documents, or when they became it became known that he had released them. Now, prominent there is the journalist, and I always like to say attorney, Glenn Greenwald, who was writing for the Guardian at the time. But much led up to that moment. Let's bring you in the picture, because there really were the three of you, in a sense.
Well, there were. The person who held it all together was Laura. Laura Poitras was the first person to be interacting online with Snowden about these leaks. He tried to reach out to Glenn Greenwald in December of 2012, but he needed a person to know how to write and read encrypted text. He needed Greenwald to learn how to use the basic email encryption programs. Greenwald didn't know how and didn't want to learn. Snowden sent him, actually he made a video and posted it on the service Vimeo and said, here's how to do it. And Greenwald never found time for it. So Snowden went to Poitras.
And then?
As soon as Laura Poitras heard from this anonymous source who did not give his name, she came to me and said, I need help trying to figure out whether this is a trap, whether this is a crazy person, whether this is for real. Because this correspondent says that he has information about an intelligence community threat to democracy, that he's an intelligence community member, that he knows things and he has documents that he can prove them. And I need to know who I'm talking to. And so I began a lengthy back and forth with Snowden in which I was trying to figure out whether he's a crazy person or a fabulator or somehow trying to set Laura and me up. And he's trying to figure out whether he can trust me because I'm a member of the mainstream media. I had worked for most of my career at the Washington Post. And he didn't believe that I or the Post would be able to withstand government pressure when he presumed the government would try to get us not to publish the stories.
Now, did he know that Laura was going to you? Was this his idea or was that Laura's idea? Because you'd known her for a long time.
It was, I had known Laura for a long time, and it was her idea to come to me. She told him, nevertheless, that she was going to do that. He did not agree to work with me. He did not agree to be my source or to give me copies of the documents until after we had probably more than 100,000 words of interactions back and forth on anonymous encrypted channels. He asked me, I mean, we talked about everything from high school onward. he wanted to know why I do what I do, how I could assure him that I was interested in the truth, regardless of outside pressure, and so on. And I was asking him a lot of close questions about a document I had not yet seen. All this time, we were talking about one document that he had. He didn't give us any clue that there would be many coming.
And he didn't want you to investigate him. That would be dangerous.
He did not. And I agreed from the get-go that he would remain anonymous as far as I was concerned. That is to say, I would not disclose his identity to anyone else if he told me in order to get valuable information for the story, in order to allow him to help protect himself. As everyone knows, he decided to come forward and acknowledge that he was the source. And so someone I knew only as Virax, which I had to look up, it's Latin for truth teller, I knew only as Virax. He eventually made himself known to the world as Ed Snowden.
Now, let's get to the person of Edward Snowden. I mean, you describe him as an autodidact, and I've always loved that because you have to have a pretty good education to know that an autodidact means self-taught. I didn't have an education, you know. So let's go there. Let's talk about his background.
So I don't know how much stock you put in IQ as a proxy for intelligence, but his is off the charts. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met. He was a restless child. He wasn't interested in rules. He wasn't interested in anything that bored him. And so he would do A-plus work in one subject and, get C's and D's and fail in another one because he just didn't care. He spent most of his time on the internet, which was becoming a thing in his youth. And he found an endless source of fascinating things out there. And he became very interested in the way things worked and how you make them work to your benefit.
Well, what's interesting for me is a number of things. While he's been described as a high school dropout, he had mononucleosis. And that was about the time a whole bunch of kids were having mononucleosis. I had a son who almost dropped out of college because of it.
Is that right?
Yeah, because you lose so much time. How do you make it up? And so that's part of why, besides his erratic, we'll say his erratic record. Then he's out for, was it 3 months, 4 months, something like that. And so he says, great, I'll go get a GED. And that would be great.
He had this fabulous idea that he could take courses that interested him at the local community college instead of going back to high school after he recovered from mono. He would get the credits from there, and then he could just graduate with his class. And the Board of Education told him, no, thank you. You are going to have to take the GED. He took it, and he got in the high 90s on all the subjects.
Now, from there, he doesn't go to college, per se.
No, he doesn't. From there, he decides he's going to join the Army. And it's because he's found out about another life hack that interests him, that there was a program called 18 X-ray, which enabled someone to join. And if they went through basic training and they passed through all the specialized courses and they had very high aptitude, both for the Army and intelligence, then they could, within a year, they could make sergeant and be a member of the Special Forces. It was a shortcut through what would otherwise be a process that took several years, probably 5 years. Snowden loved the idea of shortcuts, and so he joined. His testing was off the charts. His physical fitness was fine, and he got most of the way through basic training when he had to leave for medical reasons.
Well, he broke both his legs.
He did. Fractured tibias on both legs. And
get up, soldier. I don't think so.
Well, he tried to get up, and he fell right back down again. So he could have come back after the legs healed and got basic training again, but he would no longer have been able to enroll in this 18 X-ray program. He would no longer have a shortcut to the Special Forces. And so he came back rather dejected and recovered and got a rather menial job as a security guard at a University of Maryland facility. But the lucky break for him was that in order to get this job, he had to get a security clearance because the facility he was guarding was under construction and it was going to be a high security lab that did some work for the NSA at the University of Maryland. And once he got his security clearance, a whole world of other jobs opened up to him.
You know, it's very interesting for me because you did describe his parents. You know, his father was in the Coast Guard. His grandfather was a rear admiral in the Coast Guard. We're talking about a family that had to look down on not going to college, shortcuts in the military. This had to have been just a huge conflict in the family.
Well, it was, as was Snowden's predilection for studying whatever he felt like and not studying anything else. So he decided one day that he was going to take a course in advanced networking. And his father said, you haven't taken beginner networking.
And your point?
How do you think you're going to get a job taking random courses whenever you feel like it? And how do you think you're going to pass a course like that? Well, he takes the course. He masters 7,000 pages of documentation, and he graduates after 7 days of testing as a Microsoft certified systems engineer. So he has just got his GED. He's taken no college computer science courses, but he's a Microsoft-certified engineer now.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is investigative journalist Bart Gilman. And with over 20 years at The Washington Post, his assignments included Pentagon correspondent and Jerusalem bureau chief. And his record of breaking story after breaking story is a history of our times. Today, he writes for The Atlantic and is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. You may know him from his earlier books, including Angler, the Dick Cheney vice presidency, for which he won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. He's here today with Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State. Well, you know, this is such a perfect storm. I mean, because what he is he's got a certificate. And when I was a program director several years back of the information systems program, we had a number of degrees, and I inherited a master's in information security, which was a great master's degree, but they were having trouble recruiting. And I said, well, the first thing I said, it's just not about, you know, putting up more posters and talking to more people. What's going on here? And I found that in the information security area, in the cybersecurity area, that there were a lot of certificates and a lot of people working in it didn't have bachelor's degrees, so they couldn't go on for a master's degree. Why would you go and spend all this money and time for a master's degree when you could get three or four or five more certificates? I stopped counting at 110 certificates.
Good Lord.
You know, so it's like, ooh, another perfect storm. So we have the perfect storm of you can get into cybersecurity without, you know, any standard way through high school and college. We have the other one here where he gets, you know, the golden ticket of you have a government security clearance by being a security guard. It all came together.
Well, exactly.
And he was quite young. Yeah.
And he was collecting a bunch of these certificates exactly as you're talking about. He was a certified ethical hacker, for example, which some people found ironic after the fact. So now he's got a top secret clearance. He's a certified system engineer. And there are job fairs all around the Washington, D.C. area where there are people desperate to fill jobs in the still relatively new world of cybersecurity and cyber operations. And there's just a huge need. This is post 9/11. There's a huge growth in the defense industry and in the government agencies that do intelligence and defense, and they need a lot of computer people. And Snowden is now eligible to apply for all those jobs. He walks into a job fair, and he gets his first job as a contractor to the CIA the day he walks in the door.
CIA. I'm like, let's take a moment to appreciate this. And so, I mean, and the other thing is that you can have all the technical credentials, and if you're going to get a clearance, they have to hire you, pay you. You have to be on the job, but we can't tell you anything. And we have to wait probably 90 days to 6 months for just sort of a minimal clearance. And this guy, he's got a clearance right now. It's active.
Right.
You know, no wonder he could walk through the front door. And so, I mean, it was when I didn't really put it all together till I read the whole thing in your book and went, I see how this works. And I'm afraid I have to make a confession. Under full disclosure, you know, years ago when I worked for NASA, I had one of those super high level clearances, you know, where the which are now those stuff, that's all declassified or buried now, you know, and it was called Talent Keyhole.
Oh, I know about that. TK.
Me, I was one of them. And so, you know, you had a code word for talent and a code word for keyhole. And, you know, the keyhole was the satellite flights and the talent was the sensitive satellite flights. And, you know, they're serious when they brief you in a bunker underneath the vice president's house. Yeah, there are a lot of bunkers under there. And so it's just like I was reading this going, I don't know how this stuff works. How did he get in? And it's like it was magic. It was just magic. He wasn't the profile for anything. He wouldn't have been, you know, all these jobs, a lot of them had to have a bachelor's degree, unless you had specialized experience or specialized that. And he just went right through. And for me, also, this idea that, you know, will go on, that he gets goes to Geneva working, gets a beautiful apartment in for the CIA. It's like he's the grandson of a rear admiral, the son of a Coast Guard military person. And, you know, he obviously knew how to behave and how to dress and be well-mannered. That's part of the deal. This wasn't a nerd that came out of nowhere.
That is true. He was brought up to be a polite young man. He's almost preternaturally articulate when he feels like talking. Anyone who's turned on a TV any time in the last several years would have seen or heard him. He speaks very well, and he found shortcuts to get past the bureaucracy and to get past the fact that he did not want to sit down and get a standard college education and have to sit through classes. I mean, in a way. In that sense, he resembles a lot of people in the tech world Bill Gates, like Mark Zuckerberg, that who are interested in what they can do and what they can learn for themselves, but they don't want to sit through a structured program.
Well, let's take him from getting hired by the CIA as a contract person in, I guess, Virginia or Maryland, and he gets to Geneva, Switzerland. How did that happen?
Well, it happened like this. He was working as a contractor and a sysadmin at the CIA, helping run the Capital Area network systems, which are all these self-contained closed networks for classified information. They can't use the regular internet for that. When he found out about a job that's known colloquially inside the CIA as COMO, he's a kind of technology officer working for the Science and Technology Directorate. He had to go off and get training to do this, and he eagerly accepted it when they came to him and asked him to apply. Again, CIA, post 9/11, it's staffing up outposts all around the world. It needs all kinds of people, and one of the kinds of people it needs are the technical ones. So a COMO has the job of understanding how every piece of technology in a CIA station or an embassy works. They have to know everything from the air filtering system to the communications gear, from the classified sort of latest and greatest models of specialized telephone to the really old-fashioned ones that you can actually literally find at a museum, but they're still in use in some places around the world. So he gets trained in this, and he also gets trained in the basics of spycraft, how to live a cover story, the usual stuff that you see in the spy novels. And he names as his first choice Iraq or Afghanistan. He wants to go into the field in a conflict area. And he has, meanwhile, pissed off some of his superiors in the training school because of his usual attitude toward authority. And they decide to basically punish him by sending him to a fancy, swank European post instead of the bare bones field operation he asked for.
Punish me, please. Wow.
And you have a very nice car and a nice apartment in Geneva. It's not a bad punishment.
That's a good gig. Well, then, but eventually he ends up back in the United States.
Right. There are several detours. He spends a period of time working as a contractor for the NSA in Japan. He travels all around the world, and he likes travel. He likes picking up languages. He's got a facility for it. And meanwhile, while he's in Japan, he comes into another gig.
You've been listening to investigative journalist Bart Gellman, the author of Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation are available on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Direct links are available at technation.com. In the second half of our show, TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about susceptibility to COVID-19 and other risk factors which can affect many aspects of a person's health care. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with investigative journalist Bart Gellman about his book, Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State.
Meanwhile, while he's in Japan, he comes into another gig. He's standing around in the computer space one day, and he hears these visiting people who are organizing a security conference, a very highly classified conference of intelligence and law enforcement personnel from around the Pacific region. And they're oohing and aahing because they don't know what to do. They have lost their briefer. They're having a two-day conference. They need someone to teach a three-hour seminar on cybersecurity, on how you defend yourself in a hostile environment. How can you use a computer or a telephone in a place where you think you'll be surveilled and not give away secrets? The briefer for that, the teacher for that course calls out sick. They say, we got to find somebody else. And Snowden pipes up from one end of the room, well, I could teach it. He's got no credential that says he could teach it, although he's got all sorts of certificates. It's not part of his job, but he happens to be really good at this stuff. And they say, well, let's see what you got. Bring me some slides tomorrow morning and we'll see whether you can teach this thing. He stays up all night, prepares what the instructor tells me was the most impressive slide deck she'd ever seen on Chinese counterintelligence cybersecurity. One way or another, he had accumulated a significant amount of knowledge on this, and he's actually turns out to be quite a good teacher. So he teaches this course. He gets the highest ratings of the whole conference from the attendees. He's hired again on a sort of freelance basis to teach at this. It's called the Joint Counterintelligence. I'm missing one of the letters of JCIC. Anyway, it's a joint counterintelligence training facility, and they give courses all around the world, and they start hiring him to give the course again because he's so good at it.
Now let's get back to you. Here you are, investigative journalist. You're working with Laura, and even between you two, you have to set up a whole lot of stuff because you suddenly realize the world could be looking. All of these people are looking, and you've got to communicate with each other and try to verify who this Verax is. Now take us there. What happens then?
Well, the more we came to believe that this Verax was likely to be real, the more we came to believe he was likely to give us a genuine, authentic government document, the more we realized that we were trying to sneak up on a surveillance leviathan, and we had to do that without being surveilled ourselves. We had to keep this channel quiet. We couldn't start spilling that we were doing this story until we were ready to go to the government with it. And so we started doing essentially our own version of spy versus spy, our own operational and communication security methods. So for example, we bought burner laptops. Phones were out of the question. We didn't use phones at all. We bought laptops that we didn't use for anything else, that we never used to log on to any of our regular accounts. We installed anonymous proxies that would bounce our communications through a series of posts around the world so that it wouldn't look like it was coming from New York. It would look like it had gone to the Czech Republic and Moldova and somewhere else before it got to its destination.
And also bounced through a lot of countries that didn't have any reciprocity with the United States or anybody we had reciprocity with in terms of exchanging emails. It's like, no, we don't give you your emails. Definitely like go through the Philippines, great place to go. Go through some of these so that when by the time it gets there, they can't trace where it came from.
Well, I see I'm talking to someone who knows what she's talking about. yes, we did that. And then we also installed encryption. And so the words that we were typing back and forth to each other could not be read. And who was talking to whom could not be discerned because it was anonymous. And we went through many other precautions to keep our work private. And we used the same communications channels between ourselves as we used for this Verax character.
Right. And sort of, you know, it's impossible to stay off the grid, but you did a pretty darn good job.
The trick actually is to fill it with false footprints. You can't leave no footprints at all. You can't leave no digital exhaust in the modern communications infrastructure, but you can murk them up with sort of chaff.
Now, one of my favorite parts of the book is when you saw the document he was going to let you have. How many documents did he give you?
Well, it was a bait and switch, but in a good way. He had been talking all along about one document, that he was going to show us the document eventually. We had to finish talking through ground rules. We had to have understandings of each other. And I was, meanwhile, asking him many questions that would help me authenticate the document once I actually saw it. Because I can't take this thing at its face value. Some document says, here I am, a secret program. It may be, or it may not be. And the document, even if it's authentic, might not be true. So I get the one document on day one. And it's a mind blower. It describes a secret program that I'll explain to you soon, if you like. But the next day, I get a one-line email from Laura saying, I need you to come here. I've got to show you something. And I'm thinking, what could he possibly have to show me? We just got the document yesterday. I make my way to her hotel room, where I see that Snowden has now sent along 8 gigabytes of new classified files. And I do a little bit of playing around in the terminal of my machine so that I can count the files, and I find out that there are 50,000 and change. So 50,000 designated at top secret with SCI, meaning sensitive compartmented information. Some of the compartments were the one that you were in yourself, Moira, TK, Talent Keyhole. Snowden was cleared for those. And I was freaked out, honestly. Nothing in my experience prepared me for, you know, 50,000 documents. I was trying to even picture what the scale of the thing was. I resorted to this cliche where I said, okay, let's suppose each document is one page. That's 50,000 pages. How big a pile is that? And I do the arithmetic, and it comes out to 17 feet tall, where I'd have to stand on my own head twice to see the top of it. And I am exhilarated on the one hand, but I'm also kind of freaking out because I now know that I have this enormous cache, unlike anything that any journalist has ever had, of highly classified documents. And I now have to figure out how not to lose it. I have to figure out how not to let it get stolen. And I have to figure out how I could possibly report and write about an avalanche like this. The methods I have as a reporter don't scale to 50,000. They don't scale to 500. It looked like I had a lifetime of work ahead of me.
And then, of course, you missed two really good files that would have been helpful.
I did miss two files that...
Read me first and read me second.
So now you've learned one of my dark secrets is that I don't always RTFM read the friggin' manual. So I got this big pile of documents. They were fairly neatly organized into folders and subfolders and subfolders. And right at the top, in the top directory, were two text files that he called Read Me First and Read Me Second. And I didn't do that. I browsed around for a while first, but I finally went and saw it. And the one document was an overview of the organization of the files he had given me. And the other was kind of a political manifesto.
I have to say, I was thinking it was like an alien gets dropped into the Library of Congress and looks around, sees all these books, and after about a day goes, oh, there's a card catalog here. I really had this visceral sense of when you went, oh my goodness, thank you. Now that I see this, I feel a lot better about these 50,000 user files that are here, some of which were 300 pages long.
Well, exactly. There was one that was 7,000 pages. It was just the scale was stupendous and kind of stunning. And the thing is that hardly any of these things were written in what an outsider would regard as understandable English. These were documents written by and for members of a tribe who were insiders in a highly technical, highly legalized, high jargon environment. They would reference in passing that this relates to the Mainway program, or this is part of turbulence. And it doesn't say anywhere in the document, well, what is Mainway? What's turbulence? Sometimes you could find answers in other documents. Sometimes you couldn't. And so there were very few stories that came out of the Snowden documents that were just a matter of, here's one document, let's write down what it says and publish that as a story. Almost all of them required assembling multiple pieces. They required interviews with experts, both government and non-government. They required a lot of sort of puzzle assembly work.
Now, distill for us what exactly this revealed.
Well, there were a lot of revelations in these files, and there's more than I'd care to summarize quickly, but I can give you several kinds of summaries. The first story said that the NSA was gathering records of all the telephone calls made by all Americans. It wasn't listening into the words that were spoken. It was keeping records of who spoke to whom and when and for how long. And as you know, understanding the world of big data, that is an enormously intimate and revelatory stock of information. If you get a large enough body of data and subject it to big data analytic tools, you can learn quite personal things about people. So that's one of the Snowden revelations. The next one had to do with the NSA obtaining large volumes of information about the content of emails and documents and videos and photographs that were in the accounts that users held on big services like Google and Facebook and Microsoft and Yahoo and so forth. The government had always been able to get that kind of information with a warrant, but the boundaries of the law had secretly changed. And there was a secret legal opinion that was classified that no one outside the government could read that said the NSA from now on would just have to state a set of rules that a judge would put a stamp on a set of rules and say, yes, this is how you do it. And then the NSA could just give as many accounts as it wanted, all in one long list, say, give me everything you've got on these 100,000 people. And so it also turned out that when you obtain intelligence information about one target, on average, you are obtaining the communications of 10 bystanders as well. That's just because of the way the system works. And so although the targets were foreign nationals and not Americans, there were huge numbers of Americans who were being swept into this collection. They call that incidental collection in the NSA and in the U.S. intelligence community more broadly. And incidental is a little word that that packs a big punch because it means that they can collect oceans of data about Americans as long as they weren't doing it on purpose. It doesn't mean unforeseeable. It just means that they had another target formally. But you're in a situation in which you're an American, the NSA can't go fishing with a hook baited just for Moira. But it can take a huge net and it can trawl through the ocean and collect Moira along with hundreds of thousands or tens of millions of other people. And now you're in the net. Now you've been swept into it.
Well, looking for the whale. Well, I'm dealing with all of this with a great deal of apparent hilarity because it really brings together what, as I was saying earlier, such a perfect storm. And I would be for me, I in no way excuse what Snowden did. This enables you to really understand how he got there, and And I understand what it means to carry the weight of knowing some information which your country is holding secret. And frankly, just knowing it is a tremendous burden. I
completely agree with you. Now, as someone who is not authorized to know these things, but who is the recipient of the leak, and I now have all these secrets in my head, some of which I believe should never be disclosed in public, I completely identify with this feeling you're describing of the burden.
And it never compromised my ethics as to what was going on or what I learned, but it did compromise Snowden's ethics.
So look, there had been, since 9/11, a huge change in the rules, a whole set of changes in the rules that enabled the NSA to sweep in more information than it ever had before, to learn also, in the course of that, a lot more about its own citizens, about the government's own citizens. This was a shift in the boundaries between government and the sovereign public. And Snowden believed that because it was done in secret, and because it infringed on the liberty interests of Americans, that they ought to have a right to debate it, and that it should not be allowed to stay secret. And if I did not agree with him about some of those files, then I wouldn't have published. So I did not publish anything like everything he gave me. But every story that you read in the Washington Post came from me or my colleagues because we believed that there was a legitimate reason for public debate on those subjects.
And you finally did take a stand, and that you write that you think Snowden did substantially more good than harm, even though you're prepared to accept, as he is not, that his disclosure must have exacted a price in lost intelligence.
Right. I mean, he would like to say there's no proof of any harm done by any of his disclosures. And as a technical matter, that may be true because the harm done would itself be classified. They can't say we were listening in on terrorist X or foreign leader Y, and they read your story, and now we can't hear them anymore. That would itself be a classified fact. I find it impossible to believe that so many secrets could have been spilled at zero cost. But there's another whole set of collection losses, of intelligence losses, that are more ambiguous. Think about it this way. What if technology companies discover from reading a Washington Post story that the NSA is breaking into their infrastructure overseas, that the NSA is tapping into the cables that connect their data centers? That was one of, I think, the most important stories that I did for the newspaper. And what if those technology companies respond angrily by trying to ensure that this will never be allowed to happen again by encrypting the links that the NSA was listening in on? So you had the technology information industry spending tens of millions of dollars specifically to thwart the operations of their own government that broke into their houses. If that happens, then the NSA loses some of its intelligence collection because the tech companies are preventing it. But that's the system operating as it's intended. That's consumers being upset and angry to learn that the NSA was spying. That's the companies responding to market forces to give more security and privacy. And that's the NSA losing collection as a result. Likewise, if public pressure leads Congress to vote for a new law that prevents the NSA from collecting the call data records the way it had been, and that also happened, then the NSA has had a collection loss. If foreign governments are angry about what the NSA did and adjust their cooperation accordingly, that's also a loss. But this is all the normal workings of the marketplace and the political systems.
Now, one final question. You're no longer, you know, in the crosshairs and the active crosshairs of Snowden has it, what's going to get released, all of that. It's 7 years later. But you did discover that they already had a couple of files on you. Yes, they do. Before they really started looking.
Well, the deputy director of the The deputy director of the NSA told me that he, the way he was able to put it without saying it in classified terms, he said that I should presume that Russia and China had nice thick files on me because of the Snowden affair. I knew that there were extensive efforts to hack into my devices and my accounts. I watched it happen in front of my eyes when my iPad screen gutted out and Unix terminal commands started scrolling across the iPad, which is not normal. And it said that it was discarding its operating system and loading a new one. that was my first clue that that I was being hacked.
Yeah, we like to say I can neither confirm nor deny that there's a big elephant right over here.
When I asked for some of my files from the FBI, the CIA, and other government agencies, in one case, the CIA said that it could neither confirm nor deny the existence of any classified files about me because their existence would be classified. That's not what you want to hear. I'm still in court litigating that one.
Oh, really? Oh.
Well, I'm sorry to say you're now associated with me. You're only one hop away.
I know. They'll say, you again? I know how it feels. I know how it feels. We have not gotten to so much of this book. There is all kinds of things, how you keep things secret. You went and saw Snowden twice. There's just a lot to this book. And so this interview doesn't do it justice. And I do hope you'll come back and see us again, Bart. We'd really appreciate it.
That would be my absolute pleasure.
My guest today is Bart Gellman. The book is Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State. It's published by Penguin Press, an imprint of Penguin Random House. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. When it comes to COVID-19, we know that the elderly, as well as those with underlying conditions, are most at risk. But what about other risk factors? Could a person be genetically susceptible to COVID-19? TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft.
Yeah, well, we know, as you mentioned, our genes certainly play a role at our risk for disease, what drugs might work, and how we might recover. And now we're starting to ask the question of, you know, how do your personal genetics interact with your risks of dying or having a really bad case of coronavirus? Because it's not just about the pathogen, in this case, the virus, it's also about the host. And each of us has different characteristics, our age, our blood type, all of which...
Our
blood type is driven by our genetics. It seems
our blood type is driven by our genetics, right?
And our certain form of how our immune system is wired, our ability to metabolize certain drugs that might treat coronavirus will certainly be driven by our pharmacogenetics. So the question's being asked: who are the patients who are ending up in the hospital and on a ventilator and dying, and do they have genes that are associated with this? And very recently, the COVID-19 Host Genetics Initiative was launched, which is a project involving about 700 scientists around the world who are comparing the DNA from pandemic, you know, COVID-19 pandemic victims, their profiles to folks who didn't end up as sick or dying. And so it's a really exciting, you know, crowdsource initiative around the world to start making sense of this so we can start maybe even identifying, because we know that men seem to have a higher risk factor of dying. Is that based on the fact that they have, you know, one X chromosome? We're understanding the potential role of our ACE2 receptors. Those are the receptors that are on many of our cells. You may have heard of ACE2 inhibitors that many people take for hypertension, high blood pressure. It's the ACE2 receptor on many cells. It seems to be the pathway that the virus, the COVID-19 virus, uses to enter cells. So if you have a different genetic subtype of that receptor, maybe you'll have different susceptibilities. So that's one hot area that the geneticists are looking at as an example of differences between individuals and their susceptibility to being infected, or if they are infected, to how pathogenic that disease will be.
This is what happens with new things that we've never seen before.
Well, yeah, this is an example of how rapidly teams and innovation are coming together. I mean, there's a great story summarizing this by David Ewing Duncan in the April 30th edition of Vanity Fair. But it's, you know, it's encouraging. You know, we've talked in the prior episodes how the COVID-19 pandemic crisis is catalyzing all this new energy and thinking and science, and hopefully that the application of that science and those collaborations will go well beyond COVID, but may even catalyze new cures for cancers to other diseases that might save many times more lives than those who are dying or being affected by the coronavirus. But this particular initiative, I think, is exciting because it's happening quickly. It hopefully is going to lead to actionable information. One of the challenges we have in the clinical endeavor, on the front lines, that is if a patient rolls into the emergency room with shortness of breath and symptoms of COVID and test positive, do you need to admit that patient? Are they likely to get sick or not? What are their risk factors, genetic or otherwise, which is going to guide, do you put them in the intensive care unit? Do you send them home? Is it going to start to guide what drugs we might give very early in their course of infection versus later? Is it going to start to guide how we develop vaccines? Because certain vaccines may not work with certain genetic subtypes or might work better or have certain side effects. So personalized medicine, precision medicine is hopefully going to come to treating and preventing COVID-19, and our genetics are certainly part of that.
We don't waste any time with let's see if this will work anymore.
Well, I mean, it's not just about whether it's going to work anymore, but how can we quickly get to that answer? So the COVID-19 virus was sequenced in China in early January of 2020. That now genetic sequence was emailed around the world, and teams quickly started taking that sequence and developing vaccines, some of which have already entered clinical trials less than 3 months later. So we can start to accelerate using the genetics, not just of the pathogen, but also potentially of the patients who are positively affected, start to apply machine learning, big data, institutions from around the world to emerge. And we've talked about, you know, data competitions in the past. Maybe that data can go online, and data scientists, whether you're a grandma with a statistics degree or a grad student in statistics, can start to look at that information, and sometimes solutions may come from unexpected places.
Show me that data. I want to work on it.
Show me the money. Show me the data. Show me the genome. Show me the physiome. And, you know, we're learning in health and medicine but we can really move to an era where it's the combination of our omics, our not just our genes, but our genome, our metabolome, our microbiome, our phenome, you know, all these omes. The problem is that it's overwhelming, and it's not that they act in silos. It's when we see them in combination, and that needs the power of big data machine learning to make sense of it. So potentially, maybe a year or so from now, you'll have your own sort of genetic risk score for COVID-19, just like some people are more susceptible to the flu or are going to respond well or not well to a certain drug. And that's going to really help guide our recovery and our treatment and prevention of COVID-19 into the future.
Daniel, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Mara.
TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft is the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.